President Obama will sign a budget plan this week. It's a short-term, six-month plan that Congress passed last week. The plan makes certain that the $85 billion in automatic across-the-board spending cuts, we all know now that is the sequester, will remain in place for the fiscal year. But try to figure out exactly what those sequester cuts will mean to our everyday lives. That is a challenge. So let's call in Todd Spangler. He covers the nation's capital for the Detroit Free Press, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Todd. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So we've had this sequester in effect for about a month, and we can look back a little bit over the past few weeks and ask the question, did the sky fall?
Pretty clearly it didn't. When this happened, people, particularly on the Republican side, were saying the White House, the Democrats were exaggerating what the effects were going to be. So far, we've seen very little. But part of that is because we always knew it was going to take time for these effects to be felt. And in the meantime, we've had some changes in Congress that may have blunted some of the effects as well.
So I guess we need to see if we can possibly, in this conversation, sort out the political hyperbole from the reality. Because so much of what we've heard about, if sequestration takes effect, here's what's going to happen with teachers and schools and Head Start. That came from the White House and from agencies, right?
Absolutely. And you had the White House, you had the agencies around the state lobbying hard for there to be some kind of stop to the sequestration because 70,000 kids, for instance, were going to lose Head Start services. Some of that money's been put back in through Congress and the passage of a continuing resolution last week, but some of it hasn't. And we still are waiting to see exactly how that's going to be, what the effect of that's going to be. For instance, I mean, the Department of Defense put off for 2 weeks a decision on sending out their layoff notices, their furlough notices to some 800,000 civilian employees. We still got another week or so before we find out what's happening with that.
So they've talked about it, but we don't know for certain when or if that will happen to how many people.
That's right. Because the real change here was that, last week we had the Senate and then the House again pass what's called a continuing resolution, which will end up funding government for the next 6 months. It'd get us through the rest of the fiscal year. While they did that, they moved some money around to try to cover some things in the sequester they wanted to make sure didn't happen, like Customs and Border Patrol agents not being furloughed, moved some money around the Department of Defense. And in so doing, it changed what the effect of sequestration is ultimately going to be. Now the agencies are trying to sort out what that effect is going to be versus what it was a few weeks before that.
So for all the things we've been hearing about, you can expect huge long lines when you go through the TSA checkpoints at the airport, or kids are going to lose lunches, or kids aren't going to get inoculations that they use. So it sounds like we don't know yet.
That's right. We don't, because some of this stuff has to really work its way through the system. The real difference here is that when sequestration went into effect and the way it was planned, it was an across-the-board cut. Different percentages for different agencies, but it was an across-the-board cut. And agencies really were supposed to just lop off things if programs that were there. By going back into it as part of this Budget Appropriation Act from last week, mm-hmm. Congress was able to move some money around, say, spend on this but don't spend on that. For instance, there was $500 million in NASA's budget for a space shuttle program that doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, getting that out of there and moving it somewhere else, doing things like that. So there has been some refinement, some parts of the sequester that they've been able to sort of tamp down. Whereas other things, like TSA, is still going to take a cut. The FAA didn't get money put back in, and last week we were reporting how, some towers at some small airports are going to shut down.
However, it doesn't mean that flights won't be taking off and landing at those airports either, will it?
No, it doesn't. Everything we've heard from these smaller airports is that they can generally keep going even without tower personnel there, either by finding ways to pay for the tower personnel themselves or scaling back in some way. It's really more of a suspenders and belt kind of approach to safety. But, when you're flying, particularly through a busy area like Detroit, you'd probably like to have that tower there as well as all the other safety measures on the ground.
Hearkening back to what you said is happening now with this continuing resolution, calls to mind my mother's old farm expression, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. So shuffling a little here, shuffling a little there. So there's, with so much of that going on, I guess it has to be very hard for folks like you who are tasked with bringing us the clear story to figure out what is that clear story.
It absolutely is. And I got to tell you, there's no answer to what that clear story is. When I tried to talk earlier today to some Head Start officials, they can't tell me how much money Head Start in Michigan is going to get or going to lose. They can't tell me yet, you know, what the effect of this is going to be. The Department of Labor, which has said that there could be a 9% cut in federal unemployment benefits under the EUC program, a sort of an extension of the unemployment benefits program, still waiting to hear from them. Is that cut going to go through or is it not going to go through? Was it changed by the sequester, by the continuing resolution after that? So, yes, there's still very, very, very much confusion out there as to exactly how this is going to play out. Like I said, right now you've got 800,000 civilian employees for the Department of Defense across the country who are waiting to see if they're going to get furlough notices or not and lose a day of pay a week for the rest of the year.
And that would certainly be felt in Michigan, certainly with TACOM and Selfridge and on. So Michigan
Absolutely.
Would certainly feel that.
Absolutely, and all over the place. There's very few states where it wouldn't be felt. I think there's something like 10,000 workers who would be affected in Michigan. They might still be. Or on the other hand, because there was some money added back into the Defense Department's Operation and Maintenance Fund, it may keep some of those people working rather than have them furloughed. That's what they're trying to sort out right now.
This whole confusion, I bet you can agree, and I'm sure you hear from readers, isn't this what just makes people nuts? Just exasperates the voting public and contributes to, for example, the terrible approval ratings for Congress.
Absolutely. Well, and it's not just, I mean, it frustrates me. I'm sure it frustrates you. I mean, it's very difficult to get your hands wrapped around what do these things mean. And part of the problem with that is that Congress hasn't gone through, you know, a normal budgeting procedure, a normal appropriations procedure for years. Because of the partisan divide here, because of everything needing 60 votes in the Senate to pass, it's been impossible to get a real appropriation, the normal appropriations process followed for quite a few years now, and that's part and parcel of what makes this so frustrating to sort out. It's being done on the fly, it's being done last minute, 6 months at a time, and that just makes it hard for agencies, too, to figure out what they're going to spend on and what they're not going to spend on.
And it does have that sense of the boy who cried wolf. When I see that list that the White House put out last month saying, okay, Michigan, here's what it's going to do to middle-class families and jobs and economic security. So they put this whole list out of all these dire things that are going to happen. Then you have House Speaker Boehner saying, well, the White House needs to spend less time explaining to the press how bad the sequester will be and more time actually working to stop it. As gridlocks go and political showdowns go in Washington, is this about as bad as you've seen?
In fact, I think it's gotten a little better of late, to be honest. What has kind of happened is that while during the whole talk of the sequester, you had both sides taking hard lines on this, mm-hmm. everyone knew there was going to have to be a continuing resolution or government was going to shut down. And Republicans have shown they really don't have much stomach for shutting down the government at this point, although they want to get the cuts that they feel the deficit requires.
Yeah.
So they knew the continuing resolution was going to have to be hashed out. They moved around some cuts in there. They sent something over to the Senate that the Senate Democrats and Republicans were able to come together on. And in fact, right now on that topic, it looked like it was a pretty bipartisan agreement.
They were actually all congratulating each other, weren't they? And didn't even the Obama White House, didn't President Obama go on what was called a charm offensive?
Yes. Well, he went on that trying to, because what he's looking at is what next year budget is going to be and how can they get what they want while at the same time limiting cuts out of the House. There's going to be a lot of back and forth on this, but we seem to have reached a place where there might be some common ground, maybe not as much as you would like, but at least when it comes to shutting down the government or keeping it open, they do seem to find common ground to keep things running.
You know, I wonder, as you're reporting all of this, Todd Spangler, as you're reporting on this for the Detroit Free Press, do you ever find yourself wondering how this is all going to read for a generation or two down the road when they study American history?
You know, honestly, I think that this will be considered a very divisive period when there was a lot of arguments made, but I actually hold out hope that what will come out of this is some sort of path forward, because there's no questioning the fact that, you know, financially, the country does have issues to settle. It does have to settle a Medicare issue. Mm-hmm. It does have to settle a Social Security issue. It does have to settle what the size of its Defense Department is going to be. And maybe the arguments happening right now will actually lead to something that, you know, down the road, people will look back and say, these guys made the right decisions. I hope so.
Kind of like labor pains.
Kind of like labor pains.
Todd Spangler covers the nation's capital for the Detroit Free Press, and he was kind enough to join us from Washington. Todd, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Should the Michigan Department of Natural Resources have the power to set aside an area of land specifically to maintain biological diversity? which basically means protecting the variety of plants and animals living in that area. That's the question that has fueled passage in the state Senate of Senate Bill 78. It would prohibit the state DNR from setting aside land to maintain biodiversity. Senate Bill 78 is sponsored by Senator Tom Casperson, a Republican from Escanaba's 38th District. He thinks the DNR should have to ask permission from the legislature each time it wants to set aside land. Well, 2 weeks ago, Stateside talked with Senator Casperson. Today, we're talking with Marv Roberson, who's a forest ecologist with the Sierra Club. And Marv joins us now from outside Marquette. Welcome to Stateside, Marv.
Thank you for having me.
So the DNR, Marv, had been planning to create these biodiversity stewardship areas on both state and private land. How important is it to have those areas set aside?
Well, I guess first I would quibble with the term set aside.
Okay.
Set aside sounds like you're not going to be able to use it for anything, whereas these areas were going to be managed very specifically for conservation and restoration of biological diversity. And the program was really interesting. It was both visionary and innocuous. It was visionary because it was the first time any land management agency ever had said, what's the variety of natural plant communities we've got across the landscape, and where can we manage for the best examples of those varieties, instead of just saying, hey, this place is really cool, let's protect it.
Okay.
And it was innocuous in that it wouldn't have caused any cease in the flow of timber, no job loss, no recreational loss, certainly no loss of human access, as has been described by Senator Casperson.
So
it was an opportunity to show that we've got room for industry, recreation, and biodiversity.
And it does seem as the planning process was happening for these biodiversity stewardship areas that most everybody was on board, environmentalists and hunting groups. So what happened to derail things?
A very small number of people, including some of Mr. Casperson's constituents, became convinced incorrectly that the biodiversity stewardship areas would be places where no human activity could take place. There was nothing in the documents that created this process to indicate that, and there was certainly never intent on anyone's part who was part of the process to make that the case. But that was Mr. Casperson's concern.
And from that, then he revived that bill. We know that he had tried that last fall with Senate Bill 1276 that passed the Senate but was never brought up in the House.
Well, and the interesting thing is he expressed his concern over loss of human access, and then he introduced a bill which didn't prevent loss of human access, didn't address that question at all, simply outlawed managing for biodiversity. And when a bill was offered by Rebecca Warren that did address loss of human access, he voted against it. So his bill doesn't address the problems that he has identified.
All right. Well, we had Senator Casperson talking to Lester Graham here on Stateside 2 weeks ago. Here is what he said. I want to play it, and then I'd like your thoughts.
Biodiversity can mean different things to different parts of the land. And so we think there should be more oversight for that decision to be made, because it seems like it's dependent upon who's in charge that gets to do that. And we have a concern with that, especially when you look at what they already have. A lot of the argument was against this was made, I believe, to almost come across like if they don't have this specific ability or terminology or however you want to put it, that they're done. They can't do anything to protect biodiversity. And I don't believe that to be true, not with 22 different tools in the toolbox to do exactly that.
So Senator Casperson, Marv, believes the DNR already has what it needs to preserve biodiversity, and there should be more oversight. So your reaction?
Well, a couple things. First of all, nobody's saying that without BSAs we can't protect biodiversity. What we are saying is that under his bill, which goes well beyond eliminating BSAs, it eliminates management for biodiversity. So for him to say you can still manage for biodiversity after he's passed a bill that prohibits managing for biodiversity is a bit disingenuous at best. The other thing is he says he wants the DNR to come and ask for permission from the legislature to designate a BSA.
With each occurrence, yeah.
Unfortunately, what his bill does is outlaws designating them, period. The Michigan Natural Areas Program says if you want to designate a natural area, you come to us, you ask us, we pass it, it gets designated. This bill has no provisions like that. This bill simply outlaws designating BSAs, period.
Why do you think the Michigan United Conservation Clubs favors this Senate Bill 78?
I don't have a good answer for that unless they are concerned about hunting access.
Huh. If
they are concerned about hunting access, that's a misplaced concern because there's no loss of access under this program whatsoever. The program was designed by a multi-stakeholder group, including the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, the Michigan Association of Timbermen, Michigan-Wisconsin Timber Producers Association, and a wide variety of other conservation groups. So this is not an environmentalist sneak play.
And when Senator Casperson was on Stateside 2 weeks ago, he actually basically referred to you by name. So talk to us about that reference and what you'd like to say.
Sure. He said that since I had described this as the culmination of 20 years worth of work, that there should have been other people at the table and not just me. Well, it is the culmination of 20 years of work. I've been trying to get balance in the DNR's management between hunting, fishing, timber management, and biodiversity for a long time, and this was a real good step in that direction. But I wasn't the only person at the table. As I mentioned, there were timber industry groups at the table as well, designing this process and signing off on it.
And his reference also in the clip that we had just played, where he said there was a concern that it kind of sounds like if they don't get this specific ability that they're done, they can't do anything to protect biodiversity. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that that's not correct. And if all he was doing was outlawing BSAs, I'd still be concerned and I'd still be unhappy. What we're saying is that if you outlaw BSAs, that's one thing. If you outlaw managing for biodiversity, that's a different thing. And that's what his bill does. We're not claiming that the loss of BSAs means you can't manage for biodiversity. We're claiming that if you pass a bill that prohibits managing for biodiversity, then right, you can't manage for biodiversity.
Give us a sense, when you say managing for biodiversity, Marv Roberson, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Sure. Mr. Casperson said that anybody can just call it whatever they want, depending upon who's in charge. But under this program, there's a list of 76 natural communities, plant communities that occur in Michigan. That's very clearly defined, what's in them, which types of plants, which distributions. It's very clearly set out. It's not just somebody saying, oh, I think this is biodiversity over here, and I think that's biodiversity over there.
So what would it mean?
Well, for instance, in the Northern Hardwoods community, Northern Mesic Forest, the primary timber types are maple, beech, hemlock. In many areas of the state, we're having a very difficult time regenerating hemlock, so we don't have the complete suite of biodiversity in that community. So doing things like reducing deer densities in that area because deer browse hemlock seedlings is one way to restore biodiversity. Hmm. The other thing to keep in mind is that this bill has a lot of unintended consequences. It prohibits the department from managing or designating areas to restore biodiversity. If the department wanted to designate an area for Kirtland warbler critical habitat, that's restoring biodiversity. If the department wanted to designate an area for restoring elk habitat, that's restoring biodiversity. So a lot of things that even Mr. Casperson, I would assume, likes will be outlawed under this bill.
So Casperson, we know, introduced, as we were mentioning, a similar bill last fall that was Senate Bill 1276. It passed the Senate, but it was never even brought up in the House. And Governor Snyder said last fall he did not support Senate Bill 1276. So now here we are with Senate Bill 78. What's your sense of whether, or do you have any sense as to whether, number one, it's going to be brought up in the House, and number two, whether the governor does or doesn't support this newest version?
I certainly can't presume to speak for what the governor mm-hmm. intends to do, and I haven't spoken with him or his staff about that. My sense is that there's not a lot of interest, either for or against it, in the House right now. So my guess is that it'll certainly get a hearing just out of courtesy, but whether it'll go any further than that, I don't know. I certainly hope not.
How very crucial do you feel it is to have these BSAs, to have these biodiversity stewardship areas?
Well, again, there are two separate questions. The one is, how crucial are the BSAs? And I think they're very important and very visionary, and we're a great opportunity to show, as I said, that we've got room for all.
Mm-hmm.
The second question, which is a different question, is this bill a good idea? Because this bill doesn't just outlaw BSAs. It outlaws biodiversity management. Defeating this bill is very crucial. Having the BSAs would be wonderful and important, but losing them isn't the end of the world.
Marv Roberson, a forest ecologist with the Sierra Club, talking about Senate Bill 78, and that was, of course, sponsored by Senator Tom Casperson, should any of you who are listening want to pursue this further with your legislator. Marv, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Marv joined us from outside Marquette. Marv is a forest ecologist with the Sierra Club. So, moms and dads, you say you have a kid who can't get his or her nose out of comic books or graphic novels, and that kid can't stop doodling and drawing. Well, then you need to listen to the story of my next guest, because he is proof positive that comic book devotion and drawing talent can land you in the very front ranks of America's comic book artists. Ryan Stegman grew up in Troy. These days he lives in Grand Blanc. And from his basement studio, Ryan Stegman is drawing Spider-Man. He has been commissioned to draw the brand new Superior Spider-Man series from Marvel Comics. Ryan Stegman joins us now in the studio. So how old were you when you fell in love with comics?
When I was younger, I actually moved to Pennsylvania for 3 years from third to fifth grade. And I had a friend out there that was really into them, and I hadn't been into them. I was really into animation, Disney movies and all that stuff prior to that. And then I found comic books and got really into it. But then we moved away in fifth grade back to Michigan, to Troy. And I kind of, we just didn't really have a store around us. And then I happened in a store, and it just, when I was 15, and it all just came right back.
And what was it? What was it that hooked you?
Oh, the art. Absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, I loved to draw always. And I knew I wanted to do something with drawing. I kind of thought I wanted to be an animator for a long time. And then I don't know, that just kind of, it lost its luster for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I picked up comic books, I looked at them and I was like, oh, like for some reason before that it hadn't really registered with me that somebody drew them. You know what I mean?
There they are. They're just there.
I knew I liked the art, but I didn't, you know. And then I saw that and I just was like, oh, that's something I can do with this ability to draw. Because I knew I had that ability. I just didn't know what you could do with it, you know.
So how did a high school kid from Troy who was going to the comic book store saying, I want to draw Spider-Man someday, how did that come to be?
Well, at that age, when I was 15 and I decided that I wanted to do it, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I immediately told my parents who, you know, up to that point were probably like, what's he going to do? Because, you know.
All he does is read comic books and draw.
Yeah. And they were on board with it right away. And then I started going to conventions because there are some good local conventions, Motor City and there's Detroit Fan Fair now. And I would go meet artists and ask them questions, and I'd bring art to them and they'd tell me what I was doing, you know, well or not well. And I kept doing that. And then I went to college. I went to Michigan State. Didn't do anything with art.
What'd you do?
English degree.
Okay.
Because I also like writing.
All right.
I also like writing. And during that time, I kind of let it go by the wayside. But then when I finished, I moved back home and said, Mom and Dad, this is what I'm going to do. I was having trouble getting a job with my English degree. About a year into living there, I started getting paid to draw for smaller companies, and then I just kept working my way up.
So tell me what it was like when Marvel Comics said, all right, Ryan Stegman of Michigan, we want you to draw Spider-Man.
Well, it was before I did Superior Spider-Man, I did an issue of Amazing Spider-Man, which was the original series that the Stan Lee created, you know, series. And I did one issue of that. And the day that my son Oliver was born, he's 2 years old right now. That day, literally, this is not made up. After he was born, about an hour later, I got an email that asked me if I wanted to draw Amazing Spider-Man. It was crazy because that's literally the thing that I always wanted to do. Even if I would have just done that one issue and never drawn another issue, I would have been like, I accomplished a life's goal. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that it was just really thrilling. And then after that, I did a couple other books. And the whole time I was like, hey, I want to do Spider-Man always. And then they moved some things around. And next thing I knew, they called me and they said, okay, let's do it. And so
you're him.
Here I am.
What happens as a comic book artist as you're creating? How does it work? You're working at home, right? Mm-hmm. You're able to do that. What kind of work goes into it in time?
I work a lot of hours. I work 6 days a week. I take Saturday. I used to work 7 days a week, but, you know, now that we have a kid, I try to take, you know, I also try to take evenings off now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I used to work around the clock. Now it's 6 days a week. I work from about 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. And then I work. Yeah, and then it takes about 5 weeks to do a full issue.
And you get a script, or how does they get this? So writer sends you a script.
Right. Well, the writer sends it to the editors.
Mm-hmm,
the editors.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the editors forward it to you, and then, you know, I just start at page one, start reading what he's written, figure out how to do it, and start sending my stuff in.
Now, you do the drawing, but someone else does the coloring. Is that true?
Yeah. I pencil and ink, and then that's all manual. That's traditional. Mm-hmm. And then the colors are all done digitally. The lettering's done digitally. So,
talk to a parent who might be listening right now who has a kid that's like 15-year-old Ryan was,
right,
making those trips to the comic book store and stacks of them everywhere. Talk about nurturing that dream now that you're a parent as well.
Yeah. I look back on it, and my parents were so supportive. And I think that there was almost like a naivete that I had about this. Like when I decided I wanted to do this, it was just like, that's what I'm going to do. And my parents were like, okay, then you can do that, you know? And so I never had any doubt that I was going to be able to do this. And so now that I've done it and I'm looking back, I'm like, whoa, that was hard. I can't believe that I, you know, did that stuff. But if my parents would have questioned it or balked at it, I might have thought about it for a minute. But their support was, you know, everything. And they even, you know, even when they let me come back home and live with them for after college, like they, you know, helped me pay for a college education. And still, when I said, can I try this? They said, sure. You know, like as long as they saw that I was as passionate about it as I was, they just, you know, continued to nurture it. So.
And you are at what age right now?
31.
So at 31, you are one of the top artists in the comic book world. Obviously, as you're drawing Spider-Man, where do you go now? You've reached your goal.
Yeah.
What now?
That's the big question. I mean, right now, I'm just going to try and do Spider-Man for as long as they'll let me. And, you know, there's things beyond that. I'd like to create my own characters, you know, something, you know, along those lines, maybe learn to write some stuff and do all kinds of other things. But yeah, the focus right now is just continuing to do this and you know, try and leave some sort of mark on Spider-Man's history.
Living your dream.
Mm-hmm.
So as we look at those Superior Spider-Man, we know there's a real Michigan tie to that Spider-Man. Ryan Stegman of Grand Blank, he's drawing the new Superior Spider-Man comic series for Marvel Comics, launched this year. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Starting April 25th, the TSA is going to relax its security standards, at least a little. After that date, you will be able to carry on board your airplane pocket knives with blades less than 2.36 inches long and no wider than half an inch. Souvenir baseball bats, golf clubs, billiard cues, lacrosse, hockey sticks, all will be allowed. Now, the TSA's announcement was greeted by howls of protest from flight attendants, federal air marshals, some pilot unions, aviation insurers, even some airline CEOs. Critics say in the hands of the wrong passengers, those knives could be used to harm flight attendants and other passengers. But the TSA insists it's unlikely in these days of hardened cockpit doors and other preventative measures that little folding knives could be used by terrorists to take over a plane. The TSA wants to free up their screeners to look for non-metallic bombs. They feel that's a bigger threat. But there is a hitch here in Michigan. Pocket knives are not allowed in Michigan airports. So which law trumps the other? Let's find out now. We welcome aviation attorney Pete Tolley. So at the end of the next month, Uncle Sam's going to give the green light to these little pocket knives. How does that fit in with Michigan's law?
Well, Michigan isn't the only state that have these. I know Massachusetts has a similar law. And I know that the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, has indicated that he believes that the state law will, as you put it, trump the TSA rule. There is an issue. First of all, the Michigan statute, as is the case with the Massachusetts statute, prohibit the knives within the secure area. That's everything from TSA screening to the airplane. And the legal issue is technically, or from a philosophical standpoint, everything from that security checkpoint to the airplane belongs to the federal government.
Oh, boy.
There is a doctrine in the law known as preemption. And basically what this says is that when the federal government has occupied an area of the law so extensively in order to provide uniformity throughout the entire country, any state statute which is in conflict with that federal policy is preempted and not enforceable. And that could be the way this could go. However, there's another carve-out in the TSA regulations.
Yes.
Remember, they're not statutes. They're just rules. Now, they have the the force of law.
Mm-hmm.
But the TSA regulations provide that if a state has a statute such as Michigan or Massachusetts, they will honor that and follow it. As I read it, and according to our attorney general,
mm-hmm.
a Michigan resident will still not be able to take a permitted knife beyond the security screening in Michigan.
Certainly, there's a push to get Congress to pass a No Knives Act anyway, right? The airlines and the flight attendants are kind of
working
with sympathetic lawmakers to overturn this decision. Do you think that has any traction?
I think that the current Congress is busy enough with other things that it's not likely to, it doesn't even rise to the level of visibility as the ever-ending gun disputes, so I can't see it. But the force of the regulation is as good as a statute from Congress. A TSA could change their rule and say, no, from the security screening point on, that's our territory exclusively. So it's going to lead to some confusion, obviously.
Aviation attorney Pete Tolley, appreciate your insights today. Thanks for joining us on State
Side. You're welcome. Thanks a lot.